Welcome to the podcast, From Crisis to Connection. I'm Jeff Stewart, licensed marriage and family therapist, and I'll be bringing the professional perspective.
I'm Jody Stewart, unlicensed wife, mother, daughter, sister, friend, and neighbor, and I'll be bringing the regular, everyday perspective.
We are all about relationship recovery, and we'll tackle tough topics like infidelity, abuse, addiction, pornography, and betrayal trauma.
We also focus on helping you build stronger connections in your most important relationships. So thanks for joining us. We're glad you're here.
It's so common for betrayed partners to wonder if they'll ever be themselves again. They can endure sleepless nights, constant stress, and regular emotional breakdowns. This can create so much doubt that there can be any future worth even looking forward to. And this really gets into a discussion around resilience. And so we've invited a popular guest that we've had in the past, actually even recently, having her back on the podcast to talk about resilience. Before we jump into the topic and introduce her, I want to let you know about a free resource you can download immediately. It's a course on rebuilding trust. And if you've broken the trust or you've had trust broken in your relationship, you are going to need guidance and resources. And so I've created a free course that you can download right away that will give you direction. It doesn't matter if this is something that's just happened recently or if you've been in this process for some time. I promise you there's something in this course that will absolutely help you make sense of and organize your journey. So click on the link in the show notes. I'll send it to you right away and you can get going, getting help and support on healing from broken trust. So we're going to talk about resilience today, especially in the aftermath of betrayal. There's so much stress and confusion, and sometimes you can feel, if you're a betrayed partner, you can feel like you don't even know if you have what it takes to go the distance or to heal long term. So I've invited my friend and therapist and fellow collaborator, Kaylee Dunn, who's a licensed therapist and a coach, to discuss how betrayed partners can begin developing more resilience in the face of devastating loss and betrayal. Now, I'll just say, Kaylee is someone that I really trust quite a bit. She has great insights on partners. She's an out-of-the-box thinker, and she's someone that I think is doing some excellent work in the area of helping partners heal from betrayal trauma. And she's just one of those people that I love listening to and love talking to and connecting with because I learn so much from her when we're talking about these topics. Very thoughtful, very considerate of both the partners that have been betrayed, but also the impact on the whole system, the relationship, the family, the children, et cetera. So it's just real honor to have her back on the show. I think this is probably her third or fourth appearance on the podcast. So she's someone that I definitely love reconnecting with and talking to. So let's jump into the interview here with Kaylee Dunn. All right. Well, welcome to this great discussion, Kaylee. So good to have you here.
Good to be here. Thanks, Jeff and Jody, for having me.
Yeah, we're super excited about this.
Yeah. So before we dive in, tell our audience here a little bit about yourself and what you're doing.
Yeah, perfect. So I'm Kaylee Dunn. I'm a therapist. I'm a licensed clinical social worker in Arizona and Utah. And I've been doing that and specialized in betrayal for 11 years now, somewhere over a decade. Yeah. I can never keep tabs on that. And I've really specialized my entire career on working with mostly partners who've been betrayed, experienced hidden pornography in their relationship, infidelity of some kind, whether that's a marriage or a committed relationship, and the trauma that comes from that. And then I'm also a betrayal navigation coach. So I've built out into being able to help more people on a wider scale through coaching. And in my coaching program, I teach something called neurointuitive boundaries, which we'll probably talk about today, which is a skill set that helps you build resilience after betrayal. You know, as I'm sure all of your listeners know well, betrayal just absolutely destroys our sense of self, our relationships, and it can feel extremely hopeless. But I know from personal experience, so my D-Day, my discovery day was 16 years ago. I got to start doing math better. And, you know, I'm a testament personally, as well as with the hundreds of clients I've worked with, that it doesn't have to be a game changer or a life-ending event. It absolutely feels like it in the moment, but that there's so much hope and growth and joy on the other side of all of that, and learning specific skills and tools, as well as obtaining trauma therapy, are some big ways that we can navigate betrayal in a way that allows us to live the lives we want to live, rather than feel like, you know, life, it often feels like our life is stolen from us. We don't recognize ourselves anymore. We don't recognize the world anymore. We don't recognize people. Other humans feel unsafe. And there absolutely is so much hope and joy and possibility after betrayal. And that is kind of my message. We can talk more about that.
Yeah. And Kaylee is one of my go-to people for all things betrayal trauma. I trust you and rely on you a lot to consult on sticky cases and just situations, or to better understand different intersecting concepts and things like that. And you're someone that I think has really just done a lot of, not only your own personal, but just really understands the research and not afraid to ask hard questions, not afraid to push against maybe some of the things that are not helping partners or couples. And
yeah.
And so there's a lot of bad information out there. Mm-hmm. And so I love that yeah. you're willing to, you know, check yourself and check others and really ask these questions and not be afraid to do that. So
yeah. I mean, it's complicated, right?
Uh-huh.
Because
that's right.
Every single situation, every single story is unique in a way. Mm-hmm. And then there's also those similarities that we have. So
yeah,
absolutely.
And I don't know if I can say this or not, but I'm going to, that even before you were a licensed therapist, you were deeply involved in the trenches of helping ghostwrite and produce content for a lot of major recovery programs and authors. And I won't name names because I don't know if I can, but it's something that I know that you were really working through and contributing a lot to this field long before you had a degree. And so there's just a long history of you really growing with the field and understanding and contributing in a lot of ways that people probably will never understand. And so I think it's a real privilege to have conversations with someone with your background and experience around these topics, because it's not like you're coming in like some lightweight. You know, you definitely have done your work. So
yeah, I really appreciate that, Jeff. Absolutely. I've been really lucky and maybe blessed even to rub shoulders with some, like you said, big voices in the field and kind of at some of the beginning stages of this work, and watch the research unfold and see how the narratives and the stories and the ways that we've come to understand betrayal has grown and changed over the years. So it's been a journey, that's for sure.
Yeah.
I appreciate you bringing that in.
So let's dive in. Let's talk about betrayal resilience.
Absolutely.
And let's just start with some definitions. I'd love to hear what you understand by that, because we're talking about post-traumatic growth. We're talking about when a woman discovers her husband's secret life, or when she's dealing with some major disruption or shock. Like you said earlier, a lot of the times it's easy for her to believe it's just over. This will be the rest of her life, or there's no hope and darkness. But you're wanting women to get into a mindset that this isn't the end, and that they can grow from this, and that there is a light at the end of the tunnel. So can you walk us through that model, or just the idea of betrayal resilience?
Yeah. And so using that term even can ruffle feathers, because I've had people ask, so I should just get resilient to being betrayed over and over again. So that's not what I'm saying. That's absolutely not what I'm saying. So just want to clarify that really quick. But let's talk about just defining betrayal, and then we'll define resilience and what that looks like and how what that path kind of unfolds into, as you just said. So, you know, probably everyone on here is like, I know what betrayal is. I've experienced it. I know what it feels like. I know what it is. But let's just give a little definition. So because John Gottman says that betrayal is actually when there's an opportunity to connect and it's passed by. So betrayal actually can be very small, and we all, or maybe I shouldn't say small, but these almost maybe a fly on the wall wouldn't even notice those events, right? On those, I call a small B betrayal, but those events that can happen and pass, and many times we might not notice them. But he gives this beautiful example, John Gottman does, of laying in bed and getting cozy, and he's got his book and his water, you know, he's in that perfect state right before he goes to bed, and he looks over and his wife is brushing her hair and a tear is going down her cheek, and he thinks, oh gosh, like I just want to read my book and I just want to go to bed. And he said, had I done that, had I just, I'm just going to read my book and she'll deal with it, she's not bringing this to me, you know, that would have been a form of betrayal, he says. But instead, he decides to put his book down and go put his arms around his wife and say, hey, how are you? Are you okay? Mm-hmm. And I think recognizing kind of this underpinning of where betrayal starts, and it can be even in these really tiny moments, can help us understand why the big B betrayals are so painful and so devastating. Because even in those small moments, we can sense the heartache that would have happened had he let that moment pass by, right? The big B betrayals I define as Sue Johnson does, addiction. Well, she doesn't use that term, but she says, you know, these three big, the big A's, right? Addiction, abuse, and what's the other one?
Abandonment.
What's that? An abandonment?
Abandonment.
Yeah.
So these affairs. There's actually, affairs, she says yeah. four. Yeah.
So, oh, the four. Yeah. So all of these four big A's are these big B betrayals that really throw relationships off the rails. And to us as individuals, are major life-changing events, right? And so recognizing, okay, this is what a betrayal is. And especially in the people that we talk to are usually those who are in a committed relationship. There's a fidelity violation. And to have these, this major event or events, right? Something like hidden pornography usually has all four of those A's, right? Or hidden affairs have all four of those events going on. So there's betrayal, right? So what's resilience? Well, resilience is this sense of being able to bounce back. And in order to do that, we need to figure out what's happening inside of us, right? And the concept isn't, I'm going to bounce back into more betrayal, but instead bounce back with a nervous system that and a set of skills that allow me to make different decisions and avoid replicating these same type of situations. Because whenever you're betrayed, whether that's the first time or the 100th time, none of us ask for that. Nobody, there's no such thing as that concept of like, oh, you're asking for this type of relationship, or you're getting into this relationship on purpose, or, you know, that old concept of, you know, you're a codependent personality and you attract this kind of abuse. That's not it, right? That's not a thing. Nobody asked to get into this type of a relationship and to be betrayed. And after we've been betrayed, our nervous system is often in a space where it is maybe more difficult for us to make choices. We are more exhausted. We find ourselves collapsed or avoidant or spiraling in cycles where we just feel stuck and have difficulty either navigating ourselves out of that relationship if that needs to happen, or setting boundaries in a way that allows the relationship and healing in a way that allows the relationship to flourish. If, for example, the betraying partner decides to get into recovery and rehabilitation, then there still needs to be that post-traumatic growth, as you're describing, Jeff, in order for that relationship to flourish. So building these skills, these neurointuitive boundaries, allows us to have a flexible nervous system and allows us to make the choices and take the steps that we need in our individual circumstances, because everybody's story is going to be different. It's going to look different. It's going to feel different. How the betraying partner decides to respond to all of this is going to be different for each situation. And so building that resilience and that skill set allows us to then make those choices depending on whatever's going on. Because if someone is in a relationship similar to how my marriage worked out, my husband got into recovery, he eventually, you know, got into even rehabilitation from those emotionally abusive attitudes and behaviors that he didn't even know he had, right? But he did the work and he learned about himself and all of that. Had I not built my own betrayal, my own resilience, there's no way our marriage would be where it's at today and our family would be where it is today. And in other circumstances, you know, where the betraying partner is not willing to do what it takes, there needs to be that resilience to be able to navigate maybe out of that relationship for the safety of the betrayed partner. So there's some information. What questions do you have?
So I want to go back quite a ways. I am curious, do you notice that like a piling up of small B betrayals tends to contribute to large betrayal?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Oh, so, and you know, we don't actually love that term small B and small, because it kind of almost gives the feeling that if it happens once, it's not a big deal. But for many of us, one time is a big deal on those, you know, events. But well, absolutely. Like when those things pile up over time, that sends this message, this relational message of, you know, am I important? Am I enough? And it brings in a lot of those questions, even for highly secure people, there's going to be a lot of questions there. And it's also important to note, if you've had a big B betrayal, like a abuse or addiction or affair or any of those sorts of things, that then those small B betrayals are going to be extra sensitive and extra painful, right? Mm-hmm. And so oftentimes people who've been betrayed will be made to feel crazy. Like, you're leaving him because he wouldn't take out the trash. You're leaving him because he wouldn't, you know, whatever, X, Y, and Z, or she wouldn't X, Y, and Z, these small things. But those are extremely painful because it's like there's that big wound there and you're just dripping lemon juice into it. And like you said, enough, even when there's not big B betrayal present in a relationship. So you kind of think of your basic marriage cases, most of them are fraught with small B betrayals. And there's a lot of that pain that is going on when people come in and asking these big questions like, am I important? Am I, in what way or my, why am I being just passed by over and over again? So,
Yeah. Did you want to say more on that?
No, not right now.
So in a lot of ways, like the betrayal resilience is really about learning how to be adaptive, whether it's a string of, I get that we're trying to categorize this as small, medium, large, whatever, but being adaptive to whatever flavor of betrayal is coming at you and giving you the like you said, the neural kind of flexibility to be able to think clearly and set better limits, self-advocate, whether you stay in or go out or even take space or move closer, whatever it is, it just allows you to have movement instead of the freezing or the running away or, you know, or just the total shutdown that's common with betrayal and injuries like that.
Absolutely. I mean, a lot of my work has been informed by some of the crisis work on natural disasters and major events like that. When Dr. Kevin Skinner's work came out, he talks about how close to 70% are experiencing this PTSD response, right, after a betrayal. And a lot of women, when I would teach courses and talk about these statistics, a lot of people would say, okay, but like, what about that other 30%? What's going on with them? Like, why are we not seeing the same response? And so I did quite a bit of digging and trying to understand post-traumatic stress and what that looks like after a major event, whether that's a man-made event or natural disasters. And it was interesting to me that, and this is an analogy that I often use, is that they did a study and they put a whole group of people into a simulation on a plane, and they got real captains of the plane and real flight attendants. And then they filled the plane with volunteers and they simulated a plane crash. And as you know, simulations, we get the pretty similar results out of simulations as we do real life. And they found that the same statistic was about true. About 80% of people had kind of a freeze response or a kind of a paralysis response. About 10% of the people had this combative response that made things more difficult. And about 10% could navigate this crisis really well. And they wanted to figure out, okay, what is it with these 10% of people that are able to navigate crisis? Because if we have this resilience in a certain aspect of our life and we can build that, then that can become generalizable, right? So when you build these skills for resilience after a betrayal, you're going to have hard things happen later in life too, right? And these can be replicable. Mm-hmm. Well, what they found is that 10%, the only difference between that 10% and the general population was really one thing, but kind of two. So some people that compiled that 10% were the captains and the flight attendants, people who'd done this over and over again and were pretty aware of what needed to happen next. But of that other group of that 10%, the only difference between them and the rest of the cabin were that they had read the card and paid attention to the safety instructions.
I've heard that.
They had read the card and they paid attention to the safety instructions. And they said they usually do, right? That's a part of what they usually do. And then these numbers have been found replicated outside of airplane, right? In other circumstances related to disasters, that we get this 10% that function. And usually the difference is that they're prepared. That's pretty much it, is that they have prepared their nervous systems by reading what needs to happen, visualizing what they're going to do, and preparing themselves. And so that kind of boils into this resilience factor, is when you have gone through this, right? And then you learn what's going on inside of my body, what's happening to my body, because that's a huge confusing factor for most of us. When we feel paralyzed, it's just like, I don't know what's happening, so I'm just going to sit here paralyzed, or I'm going to rage out, or I'm going to, you know, turn and blame my partner, which understandably, right? But to develop those skills and tools will then become generalizable to that flexible nervous system, so that, you know, after this betrayal happens, hard things keep happening. My husband and I lived for 3 years in a nursing home, and we saw what happens at end of life for many people. And life is still hard all the way to the very end. But building some of these skills and tools, we saw differences in those women and men who had flexible nervous systems versus those who didn't. And so this is, you know, something that's pretty important, I think, lifelong, as well as taking this terrible, horrible, crappy event that none of us asked for and saying, okay, what am I going to do with this? Can I turn this pile of crap into gold? Can I take all of this garbage that was handed to me, that should have never happened to me, and turn this into something that can benefit me the rest of my life? And we don't say, thank goodness for the betrayal. Like, no, that should have never happened. But someone who's been betrayed can choose what they're going to do with that next, right? You don't get to choose the garbage that happens to you, but you can choose what you're going to do next.
Yeah. And yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. So there's got to be, I'm just thinking about how, based on that experiment, when we're, you know, if somebody's taking a flight, there is a prescribed time to get prepared. But I imagine that the rest of the 80% of people that don't take advantage of that time genuinely don't believe there's anything they can do in that situation that will make a bit of difference.
Mm-hmm.
So they just don't give it any attention.
Yeah.
Because in real life, it's just not very realistic that people are going to be able to be prepared for the next big coming thing.
Absolutely.
So when you start to teach skills to build resilience, how do you introduce that concept to people that they can make choices that make a difference in where their path leads?
Well, I think something that you said is so important, Jody, which is that it makes sense that you didn't prepare for this, right? And then that's okay. I think we can listen to a story like that and go like, well, those 10%, they're way awesomer. They're better because they prepared. But the reality is, in real life, it doesn't make sense to spend every minute being like, well, I wonder if this is going to happen. And I wonder, you know, and try to prepare for that and try to prepare for this. Mm-hmm. In fact, sometimes that can be a trauma response as we try to do that, right? It's not reasonable or realistic. And so when someone, very common response, I'm sure you guys know, if people who've been betrayed are like, well, why didn't I see this coming? I'm so stupid. I should have prepared. I should have known. And why didn't I see all the red flags? But that is such an important thing to point out, that that's normal, it's understandable, and it's not something that we need to fret about. In fact, I have one of my children was asking me what I do, and I kind of gave her a brief overview and without getting too scary. And she was like, well, how will someone know if their husband or wife will do that to them? You know, my 9-year-old. And I just said, you know, we don't have to worry all about that. We'll just know that if it happens, that we know what to do next. If something bad happens, we'll know what to do next. So it's like, I just wanted to highlight that, to start with this validation and so much grace for anyone who's been betrayed, to know that this isn't your fault. It's not like you should have prepared better. It's not like there was something you needed to do to prevent this from happening. The betraying partner chose what they chose, or had whatever, if it was an addiction or whatever, before they got into this relationship with you. And absolutely, that there's that component. And then after the fact, here we are, it sucks, we didn't want it to happen. There are some things that we can do now to heal and to prepare for the future, depending on whatever that means, whether that's leaving this relationship and maybe potentially being in a future relationship, whether that means staying in the relationship and navigating the possibilities of slips or relapses or future boundaries that might need to happen later, that you can do those things now. Does that kind of answer what you were speaking to?
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you.
And I think there's a lot of self-criticism or shame that comes up for betrayed individuals who feel like they should have responded better in the moment. Like in the plane experiment, I should have been, what's wrong with me that I couldn't do that? And I think that a lot of times, maybe expanding that experiment or the metaphor, the idea here into betrayal trauma, is that your response in that exact moment isn't your final response.
Oh, yes.
That there's a chance to reset. There's a chance to learn and to grow and adapt and evolve. And because the surprises aren't going to stop, whether they're with your partner or with a child or with, like you said, end of life, whatever. Like the moment you're invited into learning resilience, the moment you're invited into this space of I can grow, the beauty is that our nervous systems and our bodies are ready to adapt. We are neuroflexible. We are, our brains and bodies are really dynamic. And there's no like past moment where you've just sort of missed the boat on this.
Yeah, I love that, especially when we talk about boundaries, because so many people will come to me and they're like, well, I've already written this list of boundaries and then he broke them. So what's the point of me learning new boundaries again? Or, you know, in that moment, right, when I very first found out, I told him I would leave him if he did it again, and he's done it 100 more times. So now what, you know,
right.
and remembering that, like, each event of crisis, right. of struggle, of hardship becomes another opportunity. And those opportunities, that's a kind of a terrible, kitschy thing to say, because ew, but it's like the opportunities that are bull crap, right? But each of those crappy moments are times where, like you said, it's another event where we...
Yeah, I use the word invitation. I mean, to me, it's an invitation. It's like, I mean, opportunity maybe isn't the best word, but
yeah,
I think
like the universe is like, it's time. Here's another one. You're going
to
pick it
but
up.
But I think it's empowering to see it as something that you can lean into instead of something that you're just passively having to just block yourself from the rest of your life.
Right.
Because then you, like you said, then you do walk around mistrusting, shielding, guarding, hiding, and you know, you turn into someone you don't even like, and you're just living in a shelled up existence, a walled off existence. And that's not how anybody wants to live.
Right. Absolutely.
Well, and I think that as annoying as that word might seem, I think it's actually important because opportunity totally implies that what's happening or what's going to happen is not all completely out of somebody's control. That
right.
there are lots of things that you won't be able to control, but when you have an opportunity, you can insert yourself and you can have an effect on the things that happen. And I think that matters extremely in these situations, that women need to like understand really deeply that they can just make decisions on a regular basis that set themselves and their partners ultimately up for success.
Yeah.
Yeah. That there's an agency element to it.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we have to be careful every step of the way, as you guys know, because there's a really fine line between, yeah, like you caused this versus you have this power, right? And so I think that's where, you know, as we were talking at the very beginning about how we talk about betrayal, we always want to be careful and make sure we're overemphasizing the reality that you didn't cause this to happen to you, just like someone didn't cause an airplane crash. You didn't cause your house to catch on fire. You didn't cause whatever, right? A boat to sink. And after the event occurs, and those for betrayal, especially if there's an addiction component, is like tsunami over and over and over again, right? But as you go, okay, this sucks. My body is on fire. I'm having a survival response. I'm quite reactive. I might have spent 5, 10, 15, 20 years in that walled off avoidant space. All of that is okay. That's a big piece I teach people too, is that the survival response, the 80% or the 90%, that's okay.
Mm-hmm.
Because your body is doing what it's meant to do when it's walled off or it's frozen or it's raging out and throwing lamps and screaming at people, or it's, you know, collapsed and just like, who cares? They're all this way. I'll just let it pass by. Or it's the, you know, I'm going to fix him and I'm going to therapize him, whatever, right? All of those responses are survival responses to a primal level threat, which betrayal is a primal level threat. And so it's not that you're a bad person for reacting these ways. And even if it's been 5, 10, 15, 20 years of that, that's okay. That's okay. And we don't have to hate that part of ourselves. We can say, I survived. That's pretty amazing considering what I've been through. And I'm tired and I'm ready
for something different.
To thrive. I'm ready.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I'm ready
That's
to
right.
tap into my inner sage a little more, my intuition a little more, my regulated, flexible neuro self a little more.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So whatever place that the person's on, we can absolutely, and not in a condescending way at all. Like I threw an apple, I threw a phone. I mean, I've had my moments, right? I've done all the things. I've been to every one of those places I just described. And I lived in all of those places for long periods of time. So I'm speaking from a personal space to say, like, it's okay. It's okay that you've lived here for however long it's been. And there's not shame in that, because it was all survival, because you didn't choose it. And then whenever you're ready, and that's different for every person, you know, financially, systemically, there's so many different factors at play as to when a person is like, okay, I think I want to try something different for a while. And then that's where you start to build, you know, build that resilience in a different way. Mm-hmm.
What are some places where a betrayed partner can start building resilience? And it can seem such a vague concept.
Yeah, yeah.
Just like digging deep and having my willpower, you know. What are some specific things?
Yeah,
what does that look like?
Example. Because the reality is most people have, at least for a little while, right? And then we often get triggered and go back into a survival headspace.
Sure.
So some of it is like kind of annoying when you're in it. I remember hearing some of the concepts like, you should do yoga, you should do deep breathing. And I'm like, dude, I literally have a cannonball wound and you're handing me a Band-Aid. Like, no, thank you. That sounds like the biggest joke, right? Like, woo woo, whatever. But those are some small examples. Or, you know, something else I've heard a lot is kind of the weaponization of self-care, where they're like, well, my husband's therapist said I need to do more self-care, and that's why I'm ragey still. And it's almost this blame that gets put on her, like, well, you're not doing enough self-care, and that's why you're crazy, basically, right? And so that's another hard one, is like, self-care can be one of those resilience building, and kind of is the fundamental of the resilience building skill set, but it needs to be done in a way that's not, I'm trying to shut myself down, I'm trying to make my survivor sit down and shut up, mm-hmm. but in a way of like, mm-hmm. hey, you know what, like, I deserve some rest here. And I'm going to focus on me and my healing, and I'm going to journal, I'm going to go to therapy, I'm going to do some meditation. On its very small, so if you're saying, okay, let's just brass tacks it, it sounds like this. I'll give you an example. So my husband walks out of the bathroom holding their phone, even though she specifically asked him not to use the phone in the bathroom, because that's a big trigger, okay? So immediately what happens inside her is her inner survivor turns on. Boom. So now she's all the physiological feelings, she's going into her sympathetic nervous state, whether that's for her a fight, it might be an avoidance, it might be a collapse, whatever that is, right? Well, that would be more of the dorsal vagal, but she has this sympathetic reaction inside. Now, okay, that's okay, that's okay. So you notice it, you're like, okay, there's my inner survivor. If you want to give her a name, if you want to, you know, connect with your inner survivor, like it's a part of you, however you do that, but you're like, okay, I'm feeling a primal level threat. However you acknowledge that, however you notice that, and you let yourself feel it, and you're like, yeah, I'm pissed off, you don't have to throw any gasoline on the fire. That was always my go-to. It's like, and then I think all right. But you just have those thoughts and you have those feelings. And then you pause and you're like, okay, I can push the pause button. I don't have to respond immediately or react immediately. I can just push pause. And then that's where in comes my meditation, if I practice that or whatever, and I'm breathing and I'm regulating and I'm bringing myself into a ventral vagal state, which I practice in between triggers, right? And then I'm going into my inner sage or my regulated state. Some people may connect to the spirit or God. They may connect to the universe or nature. They may connect to an internal spirit, the spirit of self. Okay, what do I need to do? And then they're defining, okay, what boundaries or what decisions am I going to do next? And then we're going to do that over and over and over again.
Yeah.
What's going to happen is your nervous system's going to learn, I didn't die. I have a sticker on my water bottle that says, but did you die? Right? Did you die? Because you're just reminding your nervous system, because that's your cave woman self is like, yeah, I got to protect, right? But did you die? No, I'm okay. And I'm teaching my nervous system that regularly. And I'm also making regulated decisions. So we're like, thank you, inner survivor, for letting me know that there's a problem, right? Thank you for throwing off the red flag. Problem, this isn't okay. I'm not ignoring it. I'm not breathing away the fact that he violated my boundary. It's not what we're doing. We're not yoga-ing away the boundary violation. But we are getting into a regulated space to take the next step. Right.
Yeah.
So, okay, that didn't work for me. What will work for me?
Right.
And then we, you know, have protocol for how to set boundaries and make decisions. So when we're doing that over the course of time, we're going to build resilience so that at some point it looks like this: boundary violation, decision, right? And I'm making these decisions on autopilot. In a way, it becomes, I can regulate, I can be okay. When big B comes, yeah, it might be, I got to go to my bedroom and take a breather. And that can be with my kids. That can be with, whether it's a betrayal or just a nervous system hit, a trigger of some kind. It can be at work. It can be somewhere else. And that same skill set's going to take you wherever you need to go.
I love that. I want to go back to, I was at a men's retreat a while back, and the facilitator said something that I thought was so insightful, and it really lines up with something you said earlier, Kaylee, where you said that a lot of the times you talk about weaponizing self-care, but he was talking about it from this place of a lot of guys will come to this retreat and they'll focus so much on doing their work that they're avoiding their work.
Right.
That they'll use the exercises or the breathing as a way to actually not have to feel what they need to feel.
Right.
Or learn from their body.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
And they'll actually be so engaged in the practice or the focus of the technique or the whatever they're working on,
it's
or even the discussions or whatever, that they're not even feeling what's actually happening in their bodies, and they're not honoring, in this context, the inner survivor. So making room for that in a validating way, in a way that says, it's like there's like that pause between what do I need to do to handle this, and even just saying like, it's like a respectful, welcoming acknowledgement, validation of there's a part of me, there's this fighter in me that has been looking out for me. And whether it was shut down in the past or aggressive or whatever,
mm-hmm.
it's got my back, and I've got to really check in with her first.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And for some, and sometimes then, it is, for some people, it is that fighter. Sometimes it's an avoidant part.
Right.
Sometimes it's whatever. But what I noticed is when I first started teaching these principles, I don't know, in coaching courses, maybe it was like 7 years ago or something, I would have a group of women, maybe 10 or 12 women, and I would teach about fight and the fight response and the flight part or these different parts. And there would always be a handful of fighters that would go, oh, I just wish I could walk away. I wish I could just flee, you know? And then I'd have a bunch of collapsers that are like, oh, I wish I was fighting. And then I'd have a bunch of friend response who had like either the fawn where they're like just giving him whatever he wants, whatever the situation needs, like a people pleasing type of feel, or like you just described, like just self work, or work on him. And they were like, oh, I wish I could just do nothing at all. And they were all kind of, and you'll see this, I see this on social media a lot. People will get in the comments and they'll all kind of be like, my inner survivor is the worst kind. No, my inner survivor is the worst kind. No, my inner, like, and that's, they're all just talking about that survival. And even some programs and groups out there are built on like, this is a better way to survive, you know? And they're all just really focused on upping all of that. But all of them are valid. All of them are keeping you alive. None of them are, you know, nothing is superior. Even the inner sage isn't superior. It is just one moving part that's moving you towards resilience, right? It's just not where we end up. It's not where we stay forever. But like you said, and I think that these guys that you're talking about, I think that's a common survival response, is whether you call that intellectualizing or whether it's more just like, I'm going to work on me and I'm going to check all the boxes and I'm going to do all the right things. Like kind of that friend response is what I call it, where mm-hmm. you're just trying to do what's right. Like, I'll just do what's right. But those are all ways that we try to survive. And it's a way to survive for a while, but it's not the last step, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah. It's gentle, Kaylee. Like it feels really like self-respecting and honoring our, you know, just our own desire to survive, and likewise to thrive beyond that. Because like you said, I think we all do reach a point where we're tired of the same old responses. I think we have a natural limit to that. And
yeah.
It may take some of us years to finally say, this isn't really working. Because I have people in their 60s and 70s that I've worked with who are like, why did it take me so long? And I'm like, it's okay.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you're now asking the question. It's not
Some
over.
Some people probably get divorced in the process.
Yeah.
Probably a lot of change can happen when we're working through our thing at our pace, in our way.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
A lot of self-forgiveness, because I think that, and I've certainly been there, where I finally get a concept and it's like, man, how handy would that have been to understand that or really be able to have the skill set or reflex to do that years ago. But I know that when I've been gentle with myself and I've really worked to integrate that into my story and just accept that I was truly doing the best I understood at the time, and that it kept me alive and it kept me okay, and it was messy, and there mm-hmm. might be consequences from it or losses.
Yeah.
But the fact that it's flexible and it's adaptive, and that there's still, like you said, I haven't died yet. There's still good things coming. And I think that message has to be in front, which is, you know, it's not over. There's still agency. There's still choices. There's still, like you said, resilience. Mm-hmm. And to me, when I hear that, it's like, there's no finality to this. Like whether you stay or go or whatever you do, you still always have options.
Yeah. And I think there's some good parts to that. And there's some hard parts to hearing that because especially when we're in the thick of it and we're kind of in that vortex of just trying to survive, getting triggered, feeling like a survival mode trigger. When we're in that, a lot of times it's like, oh, if I could just get out of this vortex, and usually that means out of the relationship or my partner gets better and then I don't have to deal with it anymore, then I'll be okay. But the reality is, even if your partner does get into recovery, like mine did, hard things are going to keep happening. And like you said, the good part is there's always more opportunities to learn these things and to grow through these things. And the hard part is there are consequences when we live in survival mode and we react, right? And I'll add that we have to give ourselves grace too, because there's so many factors when it comes to a reactive nervous system, right? Like children and pregnancies and money, not having income or living in a disenfranchised system, whether that's race or religion or sexual orientation or whatever that might be. There are so many things acting upon you. It's never as simple as just we're made up of so many different systems and we're tied into so many systems. It's never as simple as just be happy, right? It's never as simple as like, just try harder. Just get resilient. Just let me draw this picture for you. It's never that simple. And so we have to be armed with so much self-compassion along it because it is very complex.
What do you do with those without becoming a victim? Without becoming passive and just sort of hopeless?
Yeah, I do think self-compassion is the answer to that because, not self-compassion says, this is hard right now. I'm not alone. And what do I need? And there's still a step forward, like, okay, what's the next step? Versus just kind of laying on the ground and saying, woe is me, nothing can ever be better, and kind of going into nihilism or it's all just terrible. And so I think self-compassion, we're often fearful that if I'm compassionate about myself as in a victim's position, that I'm going to stay here. But I find that usually because self-compassion is so regulating to our vagus nerve, it actually really does help us to navigate, that collapse space we might find ourselves in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love that.
Okay, I do want to go back to something that you said that I think it might be helpful to clarify, because I know particularly in this situation, a clear understanding of boundaries and how they work is really important, especially as many, many of these women are going to be like taking their first real steps and having boundaries at all. So I want to go back to the example of the husband comes out of the bathroom with the phone. Mm-hmm. And so maybe correct me if I'm wrong. My understanding of that is her boundary cannot be that he doesn't go into the bathroom with the phone because that's about his behavior. Her boundary is if you take the phone into the bathroom, this is how I will respond to
correct.
That is the proper setting of a boundary. The boundary isn't, you can't take your phone into the bathroom.
Right. Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Okay.
So that next step, right, is so now let's say it's been verbalized before that she knows, and the way I teach boundaries is a little thick because I give a lot of context around values and your rights and helping you know why you have these boundaries so that you have a big why, which is helpful when your boundaries are being violated. Or the person is saying, you're controlling me or you're being a jerk if you have these things in line. But let's say she knows, like, these are my values, these are my rights, and then this is where I feel violated. And I've made that request or invitation to him, like, hey, I feel unsafe with this behavior. If this happens, this is what I'm going to do. So if we're dysregulated, which is common after a boundary violation, if we're triggered and, inner survivor, very often we don't follow through with whatever we said we were going to do, right? Mm. Which is why it's so important for us to do the nervous system and the intuition building before we take that follow through on that boundary. So let's say she had said, if you do continue to take your phone in the bathroom, then I'm going to sleep at my mom's house that night or something, right? Mm-hmm. I'm not saying that's the right answer, just to be clear. Just
an
throwing
answer.
Out an answer. Mm-hmm. Let's say it's been a week since that happened. And so she pauses, regulates, goes to her intuition, and it's like, yeah, I need to follow through on that boundary, follows through. Let's say it's been 3 years. That might be a different intuition conversation, right? Let's say her intuition is like, man, he is safe and that was okay. And she still might say, I should still follow through because that is what I need to do for me, right? She might still follow through 3 years later. She might not.
Yeah.
So that's why that intuition connection piece and starting to feel really tied into whether, again, whether that's, I do think your own intuition is important to connect with, but also in that inner sage, the regulated voice, the self, as well as if you have a spiritual component, connecting in spiritually, connecting in with the universe or nature, that's where that there's a little piece in there before making that decision because the circumstances change every day. And that's why we often get stuck. Women often will say, well, I set these boundaries, but they might change. And I'm like, yep, they're going to change. It's a living document and that's okay. And this is where you're going to go to decide how to handle that next step. Sometimes maybe she didn't verbalize that before. She didn't know she needed that boundary yet. She didn't know it would feel violating. So that's where you can go to your intuition and decide, okay, then what do I need if this feels violating to me? Because like you said, the answer isn't taking his phone and flushing it down the toilet. That's probably what your inner survivor wants to do, right? But that's not going to get you where you want to go long term. And so identifying what are my long-term vision and all of those sorts of things are important as well.
Okay.
Yeah, because absolutely. There are a lot of things moving. Like you said, there's, you know, if he's doing good work or there's been other experiences that maybe make this feel like, you know what, when it's all sort of sorted out and organized and I think through it, maybe this is just on the surface looks like one thing, but I really feel like it's something different. I mean, to have that flexibility to be able to try that and then see how it feels and then circle back and address it later or whatever. Like people need that kind of permission because it's too dynamic otherwise. You can't prescribe how you're going to respond in every situation.
Right. And that's the beauty of resilience is that there's structure there. There's skills, there's tools, there's structure, but there is flexibility. And that can be scary, right? That can be scary for people who tend to be what I call like the water type survivor, which is someone who often finds themselves as a doormat or people pleasing or kind of have a fawn or a friend response. That can be scary to not be told exactly what to do because it's like, I want to be told what to do, first of all. And also, if I'm not, I'm going to just do what my partner's telling me to do. But really building up for that personality or not personality, but for that way of survival, it is important for them to be also have flexibility as well as the structure.
And to be careful about external voices, whether it's a recovery community or even a therapist or a church leader or anybody, you know, who's just a friend or family member who's saying to you, well, this is what I would do, or this is what you should do, or if you're really in recovery, this is what you would do. I mean, those kinds of really prescriptive, rigid responses are maybe what they would need to do in that situation.
Right.
But it's okay for you to put that back on them and say, I'm glad you have that clarity for yourself. And that's also, I think, a piece of resilience is being able to self-advocate and say, let me have the space I need to really think through this. Thanks for the suggestion, right?
Yeah. Early on for me, I met a woman who was probably in her late 60s and she had been married to her husband for 30, 40, you know, 40 years maybe. And he had had an addiction and he had had a lot. He had a lot of emotionally abusive attitudes and behaviors. He had a lot of his addictive, he had zero interest in getting into recovery. And I had believed up until that point, I was a young clinician still learning things and really thought, well, then the only healthy thing for you to do is leave that relationship. Of course, right? And I think this is going to sound probably radical even today for me to say this, but she was so resilient. I mean, she came to me for something related to her adult kids, but in terms of her marriage, she had built so much resilience around herself and what she knew she wanted to do. She lived the best life she wanted to live in terms of the home she lived in, the time she was able to spend with her kids, the income that she had, and all of those sorts of things. And she was very wholehearted in her ability to have emotions, all levels of emotion. And she was able to say to me, like, I'm allowed to make this choice. Like, I'm allowed to stay in this relationship, even though the relationship itself is not viable, because it's the life that I want to live. And that really made me stop and think a lot because it pushed against a lot of beliefs that I had and a lot of biases that I had. And I think a lot of clinicians have those biases and beliefs that, mm-hmm. you know, if you're not happy and you don't have kids at home, you know, there's all these things, right? Then this is what you should do. But like you said, there needs to be flexibility for the person, the human being, to from a regulated space, make the decisions for their life that they want to make, even if that's not what I would do or what you would do or what most people would do. That doesn't mean it's the wrong choice.
Beautiful. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I love it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Kaylee, we could keep you here all day. It's so cool
it's
talking about this
chat.
And really interesting mm-hmm. and dynamic stuff. And I love that it just really empowers and gives people options. And I hope those of you listening feel like you have more permission and more clarity around how to respond in these situations and that you don't have to live in this defensive crouch waiting for the next hard thing to happen.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Where can people find you, Kaylee?
So you can go on my website, kayleedunn.com. I've got a lot of free stuff on there, some trainings on boundaries and sleep and things like that. Or you can follow me on social media at @HeyKayleeDunn on TikTok, Instagram. And then I've got a Facebook group, Humans Navigating Betrayal, for anyone who's been betrayed. You're welcome to join in the conversation there where we stay awake to betrayal. The world wants us to go back to sleep, but we're not doing that.
I love it.
So it's kind of a messy space when you decide you're going to stay awake, you know, but
yep,
also that's a big component is that piece of it. So,
well, yeah, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this has been wonderful.
Yes. Thank you so much for having me on, guys.
I want to thank Kaylee for joining us in the studio today. It's so great talking with her and just appreciate all the great work that she's doing. You can find Kaylee and the great work that she's doing on her website, kayleedunn.com, and I'll put a link to that in the show notes. And she's really active on Instagram as well and posts some really fantastic content there. So definitely give her a follow. Once again, thanks everyone for joining and listening in today. And sure love hanging out with you every single week. And if you have time, we'd love to have you leave a review and a rating on the podcast so other people can find this really life-changing information. These interviews and the discussions we have are helping so many people. I get feedback all the time, and we'd love for you to help support the podcast by doing that and letting other people know how much it's made a difference in your life. Thanks again. We'll see you guys next week.